Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Today on the program, Project Censored Associates Dr. Nolan Higdon and Dr. Nicholas Bayham will be your hosts for the opening half. They'll examine how television portrays incarcerated women. Next, they'll address the question, what's happened to media coverage of police violence and the Black Lives Matter movement since Donald Trump took office? Then I'll be back for the second half of the show. I'll be joined by Ken Burrows of San Francisco State University. We'll hear from some of the Project Censored student researchers at that campus about a concept known as constructive media literacy, as well as other stories that they've been researching for the next Project Censored book. Please stay tuned.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On the first part of the program today, Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Bayham will be your hosts. They'll be talking about how television portrays incarcerated women, and then they'll look at what's happened to media coverage of police violence and the Black Lives Matter movement in Donald Trump's America.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham.
On today's program, we will take a critical look at women in the prison industrial complex. We will be joined by Hannah Mueller. Hannah Mueller currently works for Cornell University's Digital Scholarship and Preservation Services. She holds a PhD from Cornell University and MAs from Cornell University and Konstanz University. Her research focuses on participatory and fan culture, popular representations of prisons and incarcerated people across different national media and criminal justice systems.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show, Hannah.
Thanks for having me.
So today on the program, we're talking about the portrayals of women in the prison industrial complex. How are women portrayed in our dominant media as far as women in prison?
One of the main differences between the representation of female and male prisoners in U.S. culture or public media is that when it comes to female prisoners, there's much more of a focus on the reasons why women are incarcerated. This has led to, when we look at shows like Orange is the New Black, which has been talked about a lot, to sort of the assumption that there's a shift towards sort of a more sympathetic portrayal of prisoners more recently in the United States, which is true to a certain extent, but I think that also has to do with a sort of a gender divide between what people think of male versus female prisoners. So if you look at the representation of male prisoners in U.S. culture, we often get these spectacles of violence that don't really talk much about why men end up in prison, which has to do with the stereotype of the male prisoner as someone who's almost by nature violent. So we have that stereotypical image of men, often men of color, who are just prone to violence. And so it's no surprise that they'll end up in prison. And of course, this is a dangerous image that leads to things like racial profiling or police violence. But when it comes to women prisoners, there's always the assumption that we kind of have to explain why women would be criminals. This is something that people sort of want to hear an explanation for, because women are not supposed to be violent or criminal. And so if we, both in documentaries, I think, and in fictional representations, there's much more of a focus on these characters' backgrounds and talk about the reasons that landed them in prison. But even there, I think there's a sort of focus on their individual stories as opposed to a sort of a focus on the systemic reasons for the incarceration of women in the United States, because those individual stories make for much better storylines and for better television, for instance, than, let's say, talk about systemic inequality and poverty and mental health issues.
So in your research, what sort of trends have you seen as far as like the demographics of women prisoners and also the types of crimes of women prisoners shown in our contemporary media?
That's definitely interesting, I think, when we look at the popular representation. So if we look at the data, it's pretty clear that there's a majority of the women who are incarcerated are women of color. They're from socially disadvantaged backgrounds. A lot of them have a history of abuse or mental illness, and a lot of them are incarcerated for nonviolent, low-level offenses, often related to drugs. In the context of the war on drugs, we're often partners or mothers or sisters of men who are involved in the drug business get kind of swept up and were convicted and incarcerated alongside those men. But if you look at the representation in media, and I think I sort of hinted at that in what I said earlier, there's much more of a focus on more dramatic stories. So this is, if we want to go back to talk about Orange is the New Black as an example that maybe just a lot of people are familiar with. If we look at the memoir that the show is based on, most of the women that are mentioned in that nonfiction book are in prison for nonviolent offenses. A lot of them are incarcerated and convicted of fraud or, as I said, nonviolent drug offenses. But the television show, because that presumably makes for better television, changed the backstories of a lot of those characters and gave them backstories that had to do with stories of murder, manslaughter, etc. So there's kind of a fascination or a focus on female murderers or female violent criminals, even though sort of the data or the reality shows that that's really not the majority of women that are incarcerated, but those are the ones who are sort of put in the spotlight, and again, both in documentaries and in fictional stories.
Hannah, this is Nick Baham. I'm just kind of wondering what the impact has been on your work and on representations of women who are incarcerated of the cultural phenomena of Orange is the New Black. And then related to that, I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of what representations in particular are like of trans women, and particularly trans women of color.
It's pretty clear that I think Orange is the New Black has very much changed the field of research on this topic. It's really a show that for no other reason has been really important in the sense that it has just drawn a lot of attention to the issue of incarcerated women, which up to that point, I think were always a little bit neglected as opposed to sort of a focus on incarcerated men, which has been portrayed much more frequently and often in U.S. culture. And so in that sense, there's suddenly a lot more research, a lot more conference panels, a lot more public attention on these issues. And I think that's really important and a good thing. The maybe sort of negative outcome of that is, of course, also that then there's a lot of focus on this particular show, which is A, not the only representation of incarcerated women in media, and B, we also have to be careful to sort of orient ourselves too much on this one show as what's been seen as a, in quotation marks, realistic portrayal of female prisoners. And to your second question, the question of trans women, I think there also Orange is the New Black, of course, has done a lot of work in making that an issue that people actually talk about. And Laverne Cox and her character, Sophia Bossette in Orange is the New Black, of course, I think are really important as examples for the issues that trans women in prison are struggling with. And of course, this has happened at the same time as also the case of Chelsea Manning was in the media as a sort of real life example of the struggles that trans women in particular have to deal with in prison. So I think it's difficult to say this is a good thing, because of course it's terrible that the way it happens and that it's necessary, but good in the sense that people have started talking about it more and getting more of a sense that there are very specific challenges that trans women face in the prison system in the United States.
You are listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and we are interviewing Hannah Mueller, who works at Cornell University's Digital Scholarship and Preservation Services Program. Hannah, we just have a few more moments, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you've talked about many of these narratives that are dominant in media regarding women in the prison industrial complex. Who are these narratives aimed at? What do you think is the goal of having these narratives?
I think one of the, well, maybe it's a problem, or maybe it's a good thing, probably both. So there's a book called The Culture of Punishment by a scholar named Michelle Brown, who talks about the figure of the penal spectator, which is what she thinks of as the average citizen who does not have any contact with the prison system directly. So they haven't been to prison themselves. They don't work in a correctional facility. They don't know anyone who's been to prison, but they consume images of prisons and prisoners through the media, and their knowledge of prison and the criminal justice system is primarily influenced by images they get through the media. And of course, one of the problems with these kind of texts is that the people who primarily consume them are not necessarily the people who are directly affected by them. Those are also not the people they are made for. So there's always a bit of a dissonance between the part of the population that's directly affected by the prison industrial complex, and then there are the people who watch shows like Us or Orange is the New Black or Women in Prison or Lock Up and all those other shows that are out there. So I think that's what makes these media representations at the same time incredibly important, because they're the only way that a lot of people even learn about things that have to do with criminal justice and the prison system. And at the same time, they can also be extremely problematic for that exact reason, because that's where people draw their knowledge from. So even if there's a real attempt at educating people, and I think Orange is the New Black is an example of a show that tries to do that and tries to get people to pay attention to these issues and be more aware of the problems with the criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex. But at the same time, of course, every stereotype that's reproduced by these shows has consequences in the sense that it reaches people who get all their knowledge from that one show or similar shows like it.
Hannah, I really appreciate you coming on the Project Censored Show, and we hope to hear from you again soon.
Thank you.
We'll be back after the musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. And now we turn to interview Malina Abdullah.
Malina Abdullah is professor and chair of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles. She earned her Ph.D. and M.A. from the University of Southern California in Political Science and her B.A. from Howard University in African American Studies. She was appointed to the Los Angeles County Human Relations Commission in 2014 and is a recognized expert on race, gender, class, and social movements. Dr. Abdullah is the author of numerous articles and book chapters with subjects ranging from political coalition building to womanist mothering. Welcome to the Project Censored radio broadcast, Dr. Abdullah.
Thank you for having me. Great to be on with you.
Well, what we want to get your perspective on today is where we stand right now with Black Lives Matter. We know that in 2017, we're already on a pace for a record number of shootings by police, 295 so far by my count, with mental illness being a factor in one of five cases. And we also know that we seem to be in somewhat of a news blackout on Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, so we're seeing this surge in police killings and police shootings. In Los Angeles, we're up by 30% this year over last year. We're seeing a surge in response, so there's a huge amount of activism around these killings. But you're absolutely right. The media's, mainstream media especially, is simply not covering the cases. And they're not covering either the killings or the responses, the protests, the demonstrations, the actions that are carried out by those who remember to say their names and shift policy and shift the way in which we allocate resources and energy and transform this world. So there's absolutely very little mainstream media coverage.
How much of this, Dr. Abdullah, do you think is related to Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions and his resurrection of Nixonian law and order, as well as his reexamination of police accords that BLM was able to get in recent years?
And I think it's related, but I think it's also the media. The reason why we have constitutional protections for the media is because the media is supposed to be the truth tellers. The media is supposed to be the voice and the investigatory arm of the public, right? And so the media has a responsibility. It can't just shift with the politics of the day. And so, yeah, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions has politics that he's attempting to advance, and the media needs to push back against that and say, tell the truth about what's actually happening. And they haven't been doing that.
Melina, I wonder if you could speak a bit to what I see is probably a historical trend, which is that these issues that are prevalent and on a daily basis in the Black community occasionally get attention by corporate media, and whites may tune in, and then the corporate media turns it off despite these realities continuing. Can you speak to like other examples in addition to police killings where this has happened?
We can think about how the media attempts to kind of identify or sanction a people du jour, right? So we can talk about Black folks. We can think about the way in which mass incarceration, mass criminalization, targeting of Black male students for disciplinary action have all been media points and then not followed up by media. But we can also expand that out and think about how in the middle of the so-called story, the media completely dropped the ball on what's happening with regard to indigenous communities and the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so the media has been mainstream media, and I want to be very clear about that. Mainstream media has allowed themselves to be dictated to by corporate interests that pay the bills, right? And the only way we're able to kind of push past that is through mass action. And so we have to remember that mainstream media is corporate-owned, and mainstream media does have a vested interest. And so that vested interest does not include advancing the interests of Black people, of Indigenous people, of poor people, of women, of queer and trans folks. All marginalized communities can become a lead story for a moment, but the actual empowerment of those communities is not, and in fact, it's in direct opposition to the interests of mainstream media. And so we have to figure out how to get past that.
Dr. Abdullah, even before the sort of 2017 silencing of Black Lives Matter, it has always appeared to me that the mainstream media has ignored Black womanist leadership in the movement, Black queer womanist leadership in the movement, and has also, I think, significantly downplayed what the movement has done. In other words, its tangible results, people that it's getting out of prison. I'm just wondering, because I follow you on Facebook Live all the time, so I'm able to take that into the classroom and tell my students what the movement is actually doing from that sort of ground-up perspective. I'm wondering if you could spend a little time sharing some of that with us, some of the victories that the movement has had.
And I think the greatest victory of Movement for Black Lives has been the mobilization of tremendous base of Black folks. We're part of, it's really important to understand that we are part of a long history of Black liberation struggle, that Black people have never submitted to our own oppression. So beginning from the moment we were stolen from the shores of Africa, we've always resisted. And I think that there was a short kind of space in time, maybe in the 80s and early 90s, when we were duped into believing, a segment of us was duped into believing that assimilationist approaches would help us to become free. And I think that there was a wake-up that began to happen with this movement. And shortly before the movement, we said, no longer are we going to kind of sit back and try to be good Negroes and get our degrees and pull our pants up and wear suits and think that, you know, if we're like Bill Cosby, if we follow his direction, we'll be okay, right? And I'll save the rapist commentary for later. But I think that the idea that we have to resist, and part of that resistance is embracing and becoming unapologetically Black, recognizing that we're all connected, I think is the greatest victory of the movement. And now people will ask for tangibles, right? So there are other tangibles. So we see things moving right now with a notification policy that's moving through Congress right now. One of the things that happens, especially with in-custody deaths, is the families of those who've been killed by law enforcement are not notified. And so the most extreme case that we know of is a sister by the name of Waukesha Wilson, who was killed in an LAPD detention center. And her family sat through the date that she was supposed to be arraigned and waited 4 days. So this is almost a four-day period of not knowing that their child had been killed in custody. It's a horrific story. We don't have time for the whole thing, but just the idea that families are not notified when their loved ones are killed, a victory is we do have Congress member Karen Bass, one of our Black progressive members of Congress from Los Angeles, moving something called Waukesha's Law. We haven't won yet, but we will. This idea that police, recognizing that the ways in which Black people, brown people, poor people experience police is vastly different from the ways in which white and affluent folks experience police. This is now known. This is a widely known fact, and this is the result of the work that we've been doing. I think the solidarity that's emerging, and that's something that we see in pretty much every protest in the streets, the idea that Black folks, brown folks, indigenous folks, Asian folks, Muslim folks, women, that there's intersections among all of us, and that even as we're struggling for the particular issues, for the specificity of our own freedom, that there is a point of convergence where we have to struggle for each other as well. So I think that's another major victory. And so I think the overall kind of resist movement in many ways can be traced back to Black Lives Matter. And so there's so many victories that we can point to. There's lots of obstacles and barriers and challenges we still have to overcome, but we will as long as we struggle.
Melina, this is Nolan Higdon. Earlier you were talking about assimilation, and I see its connections to the colorblind narrative of neoliberals and the supposed post-racial America with the election of Barack Obama. And I'm sort of wondering, Black Lives Matter as a group, what sort of strategies is it engaging in, not only to combat the racism on the right, but also on the left with a lot of these colorblind narratives from neoliberals?
One of the wonderful things about being an unapologetically Black movement, and we always say that we are Black-led and ally-supported, is that we've also been able to push folks to really kind of go beyond non-Black folks, to go beyond liberalism. So we're not interested in liberal reform. We are interested in transforming the society. And in order to do that, in order to completely abolish systems that keep us oppressed and build up something new, we also have to be willing to confront what underlies these systems. And so the white folks that work with us in Los Angeles, it's White People for Black Lives. I know in the Bay Area, Showing Up for Racial Justice and other organizations are also involved. the white folks who get down with us have been willing to take a very, very radical approach. And our folks in L.A., they're always hashtagging John Brown 2017. They're seeing themselves as really accomplices in destroying white supremacy rather than just being kind of idle and thinking that they're good people because they have a black friend who comes over for dinner every now and then and they've never used the N-word or at least not been caught using it, right? And so that's what we're pushing. And we've been able to push our other comrades as well. So Asians for Black Lives, you see them on the front lines, especially in the Bay Area, rejecting the model minority myth. We've been able to really build alliances that are rooted in real solidarity, not just kind of polite liberalism.
Dr. Abdullah, I'm wondering if you have a perspective on the news blackout of the disappearances of Black and Latinx teenagers in D.C. I just want to give a few names here to make some of the names of these young girls visible. Yeshea Enoch, Ania McNeil, Juliana Otero, Jacqueline Lassie, Deshaun Trickia Wallace, Diana White, Morgan Richardson, and Talisha Coles.
What's really disturbing beyond the whiteout of the missing girls is also the way in which D.C. officials have really downplayed what's happened. We've seen this with regard to the missing girls, but also with regard to the intersection of blackness and womanhood generally. So that's why we have a whole Say Her Name movement that Kimberly Crenshaw and the African American Policy Forum has been really brilliant about pushing to the forefront. With the D.C. missing girls, some of the response by those in power is that, well, this is not an increase this year over last year, so we can ignore it. I think that we really have to get to what is happening to our black girls, to our black women. We have to be willing to think about folks who are marginalized along many different axes, or at least more than one axis. And I think that we as community members have to be our own storytellers. So there's an African proverb that says, until the lion tells the story, the hunter will always be the hero. And so we have to tell our stories. We can't rely on hunters to tell our stories. And so we have to push that out. We have to say their names just as you did. And I appreciate you. I'm sure that the families appreciate you for saying the names. We have to recognize also that this is not just an issue in D.C., that it's happening in Oakland, happening in Los Angeles, and it's connected with human trafficking. It's connected with a failed foster care system. It's connected with all of these different institutional issues that we're refusing to address.
Dr. Abdullah, we really want to thank you for being a part of the Project Censored radio broadcast today and for giving us a new perspective on what Black Lives Matter is up to in 2017. Before we let you go, we just want to know for our audiences how they can continue to support the movement.
We encourage everybody to get involved in your local chapter of Black Lives Matter. For anywhere in the world, find your chapter by going to blacklivesmatter.com. In Los Angeles, we are BLMLA on Twitter, BLM Los Angeles on Instagram. And then nationally, one of the things that we're pushing, that we want everyone to push, whether you're in BLM or some other organization, is really this divestment from policing and investment in those things that actually make communities safe. So now is budget time. We want everybody to be involved and to push their elected officials to budget in a way that reimagines public safety and recognize that the safest communities are those with the greatest resources, with after-school programs, cultural programs, livable wage jobs, mental health resources, not the ones that have the most police. And so please get involved with Black Lives Matter and organize with any organization that is pushing for the real freedom and liberation of our people.
Thank you, Dr. Abdullah, and thank you for everything that you are doing for our communities.
Thank you so much.
This is Mickey Huff, and you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Thanks so much to my associates, Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham, for their work on the first half of today's show. Ken Burrows and I will take over for the second half. We'll be joined by several of Ken's students from San Francisco State University, who will explain an idea called constructive media literacy and hear more about the stories being researched for Censored 2018. Coming up next, stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today on the program, we're joined by Project Censored Affiliate Campus, San Francisco State University, their faculty advisor, Ken Burrows, no stranger to the show, also with us today to help co-host, as he did last time with our show with William Pepper. In studio, we have three of Project Censored researchers that are working with Ken Burrows. We're joined by Alora Phillips, Amber Yang, and Rachel Maslow. So today on the program, we're looking at something called constructive media literacy and mindful media movements. And before we get started, we're going to start with Alora, and we'll also hear from Amber and Rachel. But before we dive in and start looking at their topics, their subjects, the stories they're researching, and hear their thoughts about them and the significance of them, Ken Burrows, let's just start with you and briefly tell us a little bit about what you mean by constructive media and mindful media movements to kind of frame our conversation.
We've been playing with this for some time. First of all, I teach holistic health studies within health education and public health. And given this particular approach to thinking about healthcare, which is a constructive one, we've noticed for a long time that progressive media, most media, tends to be about human failure. It's about what's not working. If you pick up a paper, it's about fraud, murder, crime, war, and so on. And what's usually left out is that all day long, humans are solving problems, working well together, collaborating, driving, making the world work. And we rarely talk about that as news because it isn't disruptive and something that, as they say, if it bleeds, it leads, and ends up in the front page. So we have a different way of approaching news. And how do we start articulating what is healthy and what is really creative and constructive about human life? And how do we support that kind of news? Because that's often left out. And no, that's not just the feel-better news. It's the getting better news. And we really need to differentiate that. It's the recognition of constructive realities and not just reactive realities.
Very good, Ken. So thanks for helping set that up for us, giving us some things to think about as we hear from three of your wonderful students. Project Censored seems to always attract really intelligent and thoughtful folks from across the spectrum and across demographics. But what's also very interesting about teaching and doing work with Project Censored over the years is that we sometimes find people that didn't know they were going to find us. They kind of come into a class with somebody like Ken Burrows or Peter Phillips or Nolan Higdon or Susan Rahman, myself, many of the other people that we work with, and Andy Lee Roth, of course, our associate director. And it's really fascinating, and it's also energizing to see people get really excited about these things and really turn on to these ideas. And having worked with you for some time, Ken, the students at San Francisco State are always illuminating, always energetic, and always have just such wonderful things to share, both content-wise and also in terms of their experiences. So let's jump in. Let's start with Alora Phillips, and let's hear a little bit. How did you get involved? How did you happen along into Ken and Ken's class, and what got you interested in Project Censored? And then share with us a little bit about something that you're doing.
Well, I'm actually in two of Ken's classes. I'm in the Holistic Health Internship and also his Global Perspectives class. And I heard about Project Censored in both of them. And I was kind of like immediately taken by the stories in the books because it wasn't just negative news. It had a lot of beneficial outcomes or ways to deal with problems that are at hand. And it was kind of just like options for positive change, which I thought was a really nice thing. So that's how I got involved with Project Censored. Definitely been doing a lot of reading up on that. It's been really interesting and a really beneficial class for me.
That's fantastic. So, Alora, tell us about something that you've been researching, something you've come across and you want to share with us.
Okay, so I actually did mine on an article called In Order to Save the American Dream, We Have to Change the Way We Think About Work by Ben Schiller. It's kind of just about how work is more than money. It gives us purpose, meaning, and structure in our lives, but things are changing. A lot of things are becoming automated, and we're losing a lot of jobs. And it basically just provides a lot of options towards the end of the article about how we can change that and what we can do moving forward.
Indeed, and that's certainly been the topic of numerous academic work. Certainly Bob McChesney's recent books come to mind, talking about the challenges of automation and how we think about work. Also, the political economy of what will happen if people no longer have these kinds of jobs, or what's happening when jobs are replaced through robotics or AI or what have you. I think we have another story like that maybe coming up later on in the program. Let's go to you, Amber Yang. Thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show today. So tell us your story. How did you end up in Ken Burrow's class, and how did you hear about Project Censored? What got you interested, maybe excited or energized about that? And then share with us something that you're looking at, something, one of the things you're researching.
I originally was exposed to Project Censored, just like Alora, from the classes that I took with Ken. And I felt this past semester, or last semester when I started Project Censored, it was one of the stepping stones to how I wanted to take leadership in my own life in terms of, with media, taking the responsibilities of me seeing what I want to see in the world versus what the mainstream media tells me and what it wants me to know. There's so many facets of life that's going on right now, so many beautiful, constructive things that are happening, and I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be a part of a community that wants to inspire people rather than have people collapse into fear and anger and violence and resistance. And so Project Censored was a way for me to find that constructive, critical thinking part of me that really honed in and really helped me when I was trying to find stories that really resonated with me. So I did a couple of stories. I've done three stories so far, but there's two that really resonated with me. One of them was Sweden and their recycling system. In 2016, less than 1% of their garbage went to landfill, and that other 99% went to heating all the homes in this national heating network. And it's a pretty amazing thought that someone could think of something, that a whole institution could think of something that stresses the importance of nature and the importance of reducing our carbon footprint and having those really progressive thoughts that are about the long-term health of our world. A lot of what is on mainstream media right now is short-term effects and these isolated events that don't really talk about these underlying issues that are really grabbing hold of us. And my other story is on mindfulness training in law enforcement and how that's through various studies and a lot of programs across the nation have been so effective in helping police de-escalate really unstable situations, improving community relations, connecting more meaningfully with the people they serve, and helping them learn how to better handle the physical and, most importantly, their emotional aspects of their jobs. This includes helping police officers stay present and learn really how to breathe deeply and to practice relaxation activities and knowing what it means to be the awareness behind their thoughts, that maybe self-awareness is the cure for bias, and some police officers may never overcome their biases if they aren't aware of them. So mindfulness helps that. And it's really important that by doing so, we realize that there's a type of suffering that's arising from a toxic and wounded police culture. It's not just saying that police officers are evil or they're bad or they're racist or they're lazy on a power trip. It's more than that. And it really sheds light on everything they've experienced as a police officer and all of the stress that comes from that. So I thought that was a really interesting topic, and I found myself resonating with that a lot.
And you talk about mainstream media. We usually try to say corporate media just because of the specificity of this, the idea that it's, in fact, more of what you're saying sounds like a mainstream kind of idea, right? I mean, it really sounds like something that people do resonate with or would. But we don't hear about this stuff in the corporate media because it's driven by profits, fear, selling ads. Capitalism and profits aren't seemingly synonymous oftentimes with mindfulness.
right? Or with constructive media. This is, again, why it's fantastic to hear the work that you're doing with Ken Burrows at San Francisco State University, because you're highlighting very significant topics. You're also highlighting important stories that are being published. People are doing this work. Right? They just aren't getting these large platforms. And so many people that would be very open to some of these ideas maybe never really get to hear them. So that's wonderful to hear you share those with us. And also Rachel Maslow. So Rachel, you're also one of Ken's students at San Francisco State University in the Project Censored Affiliate Program there. Tell us a little bit again. How did you get involved with the project? What does it mean to you? What is it doing for you overall? And share with us what you're learning and what your story is.
I initially joined Project Censored because I took a couple of Ken's holistic health classes about a year ago, discovered Project Censored, and I wanted to become more involved in school, and I wanted to become more involved in an atmosphere that would be substantial and not so much just about social life, but also about things going on. And hearing the description, it was sounding like a great safe space to talk about things that are going on without feeling like you might be judged or looked at wrongly, which can sometimes happen in college atmospheres. So I hung around, and then now I'm in my senior year and I'm outreach coordinator in Project Censored. And we really make it, besides a place to talk about things going on that people don't know about and aren't very aware, we make it a really safe space for people to come and talk about how they feel about what's going on, their opinions, what they're going through, like I said, without being judged or feeling like you can't voice your opinion. And then besides having these really great conversations, I was really looking for an atmosphere and a group of people that I could talk about these things and learn these things with, meaning learning stories and ideas that aren't covered in corporate media, especially after the 2016 election. It's been very difficult, especially living in a liberal city, to know your place and where you can talk about these things, what you can talk about, who you can say them to, without worrying about how you're coming across. So Project Censored really gives you a place to do that. And then on top of that, you are becoming informed of so many stories and things that are going on that you're not aware of just because you're in this space with people who are all doing the same thing you are, to look for independent media and look for things that aren't being covered. So Project Censored has really become a safe haven for me at school, and it's very special. With that, my story that I have submitted for this year is titled The Changing Nature of Work, World's Largest Hedge Fund to Replace Managers with Artificial Intelligence. So the story is about the world's largest hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates, building a piece of software to automate the day-to-day management of the firm. This includes hiring, firing, and other strategic decision-making. The firm created a team of programmers specializing in AI and analytics, and they're currently working on numerous apps for AI to work through. These include things called baseball cards that shows employees' strengths and weaknesses, and also an app called The Contract, which will get staff to set goals that they want to achieve and then tracks how effectively they follow through. So these tools are early applications of PreOS, which is the overarching management software that the founder, Ray Dalio, wants to make 3/4 of all management decisions with in the next 5 years. So the types of decisions these tools could make include ranking opposing perspectives from multiple team members when there's a disagreement on how to proceed or work on a project, and it also includes helping find the right staff for particular jobs in the company. The article also discusses the opposing opinions, which is, will replacing managers with AI change the nature of human work, and how will it change it? Futurist Zoltan Istvan was mentioned in the article, and he thinks that even though he is for AI and technology, he does believe that this is going to highly affect human work. And he thinks that soon there won't be a big reason to keep us around. He thinks bankers will become dinosaurs. And he thinks that it's needed, but it will definitely affect the nature of human work. And some other perspectives believe that humans will still need to be around working in coordinates with AI, as humans will need to still be designing the software and setting the objectives for the AI robots. But that is one of the biggest stories that I found really resonated with me.
And all of these stories are available for you to see as part of the current research happening for our next book, Censored 2018. And you can go online to projectcensored.org, and you can click on our latest validated independent news story links, and you can learn a little bit more about these stories and their points of origin and where they're being published. I'm Mickey Helf. This is the Project Censored Show. We'll continue our conversation with constructive media literacy and the mindful media movements after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, and I'm joined in studio this week with Ken Burrows. He is at San Francisco State University. He is the faculty advisor of the Project Censored Affiliates Club there. The Project Censored affiliate team is represented here in studio as well today. We've heard from Alora Phillips, Amber Yang, and Rachel Maslow. They were telling us about how they got involved in the project and sort of what Project Censored's critical media literacy program means, and you also heard with my title, Constructive Media Literacy, as Ken Burrows has sort of put another spin on that and added a layer of depth and dimension that his students also are mindful of and research. So we're going to have a conversation now about how they go about doing the research they're doing. And Ken, let's start with you, and let's have you talk about how you influence, inspire, and maybe help guide some of these principles about constructive media literacy in your program with the students.
Well, on a good day, and there are other days, you know, occasionally, we invite people to think outside the box. A big part of the way I teach is to really have a cornerstone of looking at the creative process and invite people to step into it and literally step out of their comfort zone, often in the process. So in this particular classroom that most people find Project Censored in, it's called Holistic Health, Human Nature, and Global Perspectives. One of the assignments is looking at 8 to 10 social controversies and looking at both sides of the issue. What are the narratives around this controversy, and let people do the research? And typically, people pick one of these areas of controversy and they go deep into their own inspection of what that looks like. And they usually come out surprised, sometimes even shattered, their worldview shaped by, wow, I didn't know that. So starting from that, then most of the semester we spend looking at what the world might be and how do we really move in that direction, in a creative direction. So what I know is it's just a pleasure to find a handful of students in a group of 50, maybe half a dozen or so, that get very motivated by the process of discovery. It's that time in their life when they're creative and interested and, frankly, a bit courageous, willing to step up.
Amber Yang, join the conversation. What are your thoughts on what Ken just said, and what are your experiences? What have your experiences been? And sometimes we're dealing, of course, with difficult challenges, and it's easy to get bogged down in negative news cycles. But all three of you have been sharing with us some pretty fascinating and empowering stories. So talk to us a little bit more about your thoughts about your experiences.
I think a lot of the issue is thinking that there's not any good in this world, that maybe all you see is the negative and that's all you're exposed to. And that's all your neurons are kind of used to, all those pathways that they've created. And then once you get this hope, and my inspiration was going into Ken's classes and awakening to a different frequency of life that really felt more intuitively something that I could really relate to. That's something that we all could feel on different levels, whether we don't want to admit it, whether we're scared to, or whether we're not ready to understand it. It happens. And I feel like once you find that, it brings so much opportunity to really hone in on what's out there and to know that if you really put your intention somewhere, you can make it grow and foster. And so when I started seeing all these beautiful stories like mindfulness and law enforcement, how amazing that is and how they can actually empirically see how this is working, it's so empowering. And it's awesome when you get to share that with your friends and they're just like, wow, like this is happening in this world. It's like, yeah, just believe it and you can achieve it.
Well, it's certainly good to remember these kinds of things, right? It's important that creativity comes to the table, right? And that we have new and different ways of seeing things. And I know, as Ken, you said earlier, more than just reacting to situations or reacting to challenges. And this, of course, is what you're not only talking about when you say mindful media movements, but in terms of constructive media, right? And not just teaching, but encouraging, mm-hmm. right, for those kind of things to emerge, both inside the classroom, which is great as a petri dish or lab, right? But the reality is we're doing this so that it happens outside of the classroom.
And what's so interesting in this process is to see the clusters of stories, too, that are emerging in the process. So every semester we see sort of a zeitgeist, sort of a gathering of certain themes that show up. So mindfulness stories, Amber mentioned one of them, but we have three or four mindfulness stories, including an example of workers in Syria, aid workers, are being trained in mindfulness because it really helps them stay on the job longer and be more effective and not burn out after a session or two or a battle or two when they're trying to help people. So it's really interesting to see the news that's emerging, what I call the emerging cultural news, that's often not making it into the papers, but is making a big difference in people's lives. And then noticing our own draw to that, each individual, and out of that noticing what we're finding together, which is also mirrored in part of that emergent reality.
So, Rachel Maslow, do you want to add anything into the conversation here about your experiences, your thoughts about these issues?
What I really find important to me is in today's society, we are having so much of this, quote, fake news and alternative facts, which is really affecting what is really fake news and what isn't anymore. And it's making it very confusing to try to figure out what's really going on and what's going on underneath some of these stories that are coming out. So how Project Censored has helped me the most is really how to decipher between what is real, what is credible, and what some agencies or corporations might be trying to convince us is real, or what they want us to follow, what path they want us to follow, what story they want us to follow. Oftentimes, so we are avoiding something bigger and more impactful underneath the surface. So I've really found finding my own stories, researching my own stories, and then coming to our weekly meetings and having our hour or 2 or 3 hour conversations about what's really going on. And I have found that I've become the most informed I think I ever have been in my young adult life from being in Project Censored.
This is great citizen journalism training, it sounds like,
right? Right, yeah.
Right, where you don't necessarily, and again, this is not a knock against professional journalism. Sometimes when people say citizen journalism, you know, professional journalists, they're like, well, hey, wait a minute, that's our turf. But as human beings, we all are storytellers. We all learn and we all benefit from each other's stories and experiences when we feel confident and can share them or are in communities where that is welcomed, right?
Right.
And I'm glad to hear that you think Project Censored is a welcoming community. We think we are, although some may disagree. We even give corporate media types the chance to acknowledge what we do. And we certainly, as much as we might criticize the Washington Post or the New York Times, we're also right there when they're writing a great story, you know, and winning a Pulitzer. It's not a black and white situation. And when we see the good work of a free press happening, we want to celebrate it everywhere. But it's especially important to celebrate it, I believe, among young people and with students of all ages, people that are really turning on and tuning in. That's a great thing that the project has done for 40 years. It's an honor to be part of that. And it's also great to have this platform on Pacifica Radio, Free Speech Radio, where we can bring in all these different voices because, you know, I mean, you know, KTV, you know, Channel 2 or, you know, or HBO, you know, some, they're not coming over to San Francisco State and putting a camera, a microphone in front of you, right?
Yeah.
But you're not waiting for them. I mean, you're going out, you're researching these stories, you're vetting these stories, you're sending them in, and you're being part of something. And that's just not laudable or commendable. I think that that's really a fantastic model for a more productive future in our society.
And I think at this point, if we were to wait around for some of these media to come around and let us know, they won't. And then we won't be informed and we won't know what's going on.
Be the change, right? You know, you mentioned fake news, of course, and alternative facts.
Right.
And it just so happens that I've been speaking all up and down the West Coast of late on exactly that issue. I usually start the conversation on the Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year, which last year was the hyphenated term post-truth. After the truth comes alternative facts. That's what was delivered promptly by Kellyanne Conway, the counsel for Donald Trump, in the so-called massacre at Bowling Green that never took place, or the alternative facts of the inauguration size. And then we have corporate media acting as stenographers to these people, right? It's nice that we have started to see some people in corporate media stand up and challenge these falsehoods, but we need far more people not only challenging the falsehoods, but replacing those narratives with empirical reality. Alora Phillips, we started with you, so let's come back to you. Tell us about, you know, more of your experiences in this area.
I definitely agree with Rachel. This is probably the most educated I've felt in my entire life on things that I wouldn't have ever imagined were living in the shadows. A lot of it's really interesting because we basically come to these meetings and come to class and talked about the things that are taboo and not talked about. And it's so important that we're starting now in our youth because we are the ones, like you said, that have the power to change the future.
And it's always heartening to both see, hear, read, and think about the things that students are doing and certainly doing with Project Censored. And it's also an honor to see what happens with so many of the people that we meet along the way in these programs and these classes. Believe it or not, we pay attention to where you go. We follow you around and we try to see where you're going. And so many of you come back and tell us what's happening. And I think that's a really positive kind of media community, right? We talk about mindful media movements. It sounds like this in and of itself is really part. So Ken Burrows, concluding thoughts for this segment about Project Censored affiliate program, constructive media, and mindful media.
I love coming to work. It's really interesting to be educated and be taught by my students how they show up and are teaching me about the stories they find and then the dialogues we end up in together. So it's a great job to have.
All right. So Ken Burrows, Alora Phillips, Amber Yang, Rachel Maslow, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today. We've been speaking with students and professor at San Francisco State University for Project Censored's affiliate program there. And we've been discussing constructive media and mindful media movements.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That concludes the Project Censored program for today. I'm Mickey Huff. I was joined today by Ken Burrows, and our hosts for the first half of the show were Nolan Higdon and Nick Bayham. Our producer is Anthony Fest, our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored show is heard on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers in our sisters. Crap.